So, earlier in this conference, you've already heard an observational splashback talk from Sir Hood and a theoretical splashback talk from Benedict. I'm going to be the computation talk. It's going to be super fun. So, in the outskirts of halos, there is a sharp drop-off in the density field, which is caused by particles piling up at their first epicenter after infall. So in 1D, what this looks like is a classic NFW profile, which is terminated by a steep cliff. In 3D, what this looks like is some weird oblong potato-shaped shell that encloses all the matter which has ever orbited the center of that halo and separates it from the matter which is just infalling or which is unrelated to the halo. So why do we care? So we care about this because the splashback shell makes a very interesting halo boundary. So the normal boundaries that we use, these overdensity spheres, are sort of these arbitrary spheres that we make. We tell fairy tales about why we chose the numbers associated with them, but they don't really mean anything. And qualitatively, there's not really anything different between the particles that are out here and the particles that are here. Certainly not in the same way that there's something qualitatively different between these guys and these guys. Now, I'll make two more arguments about this, and they're both speculative, because we've only really just started this endeavor of looking at these things. So one is that I'll summarize Benedict's argument, the one that he made in his talk, which is that there's a lot of analysis and a lot of modeling that we do at the level of the granularity of the halo boundary. And the tighter the connection is between our definition of the boundary and something physical, the better we can expect our analysis to be, and the better we can expect the conclusions that we make out of it to be. Now, something a little bit more visceral for me is that, additionally, the qualitative classification that we make of objects into subhalos and isolated halos cannot be more physically solid than the quantitative boundary that we draw to divide the two. Now, this doesn't always matter. If you're looking at things that are in the center here, a qualitatively correct boundary is probably enough. But once you get into these outskirts, you start to have issues. And the poster child of these issues are these things called backsplash halos. So these are halos which have fallen into the host. They've sort of followed the law. They've done everything right. And they're just passing through this region out here. But they've been classified as isolated halos just because our definition doesn't know about this boundary. So the story of this talk is going to be about different definitions and different approaches that we have for identifying this boundary. Now, you may be asking, why is this even hard in the first place? After all, this cliff is really sharp. Just pick, you know, some characteristic scale for the cliff and be done with it. Well, the issue is that even though almost all halos look like this, not all halos look like this. So about half of them are a little bit worse. So if you look in that area where we expected to have the cliff, you actually see these spikes. So those spikes there, they're not noise. Those are subhalos. Just a few subhalos are in that region, and they totally wash out the splashback. So the approach that we usually take to this is that we stack profiles on top of one another. So we take a big population, average them together, find the point of steepest slope in that population. Now, the problem is, of course, you can't really look at individual halos in this way. So these really interesting things, things about subhalo classification, things about accretion rates, things about intrinsic scatter, we can't look at any of that. But there's actually a much more insidious problem with stacking these profiles together that are caused by these subhalos. And that's that the existence of these subhalos near the splashback at all systematically biases the stack profiles. And I will make a cartoon argument of this. If you want to see a non-cartoon argument of this, I can get that to you. So, let's say that this is the profile of our halo. So the splashback is here, NFW profile here is here, and the outskirts with the wrong logarithmic slope are here. So we know that if I put a halo here, it washes things out. It just destroys it. But what happens if I go here? Well, that subhalo pushes the profile up. And what happens is if I have a population of halos and I mix in a subpopulation where this is happening, it systematically pushes that point of steepest slope inwards. And this is not an edge case. About a half of all halos, which have this sharp cliff in the outskirts, have something like this going on, and we've looked into this. A secondary effect is, let's say in the outskirts, you have a bunch of substructure. Maybe you have strong filament features, maybe you have halos that are about to fall in. You get essentially the same effect, but on the other side of the profile. So you have an issue here, which is Once you've gotten your stack profiles, not only can you not interpret that number that you get out of that analysis as the correct characteristic scale for the splashback of the halos that you're analyzing, but you also run into issues if you're comparing two different populations together. So, let's say that you have two different populations of halos and one has a smaller splashback radius than the other. Maybe one population is simulated and the other is observed. Well, we would like to interpret that difference as meaning something about the epicenter distribution of particles inside the halo. But actually, the difference between those two numbers is convolved with the difference in the subhalo distribution around those halos. So what we would really want is definitions that not only tell us things about individual halos, but that also don't get tricked by substructure. So just to give you a preview for what this is going to look like, so I'm going to go through three different methods, and it's going to seem like I'm jumping around, but they're all going to connect back together in the end. So I'm going to go through the first one now. And the goal of this method was just to come up with the simplest possible thing that we could do which would fix this problem. So the idea is that you take a halo center, you carve up the space around it into a bunch of wedges. You can use HeelPix, you can use radar pixelation, you can do whatever you want. And you measure a profile in each one of the wedges. And then who can guess what you do next? That's a tough question. Take the median. And the reason you take the median is because these subhalos, if they are really the problem with these profiles, subtend a small angular width. So they'll only inhabit a couple of these wedges, and when you take the median, they'll go right away. So let's see. Let's take that halo that was messing us up before, and let's just apply a median profile of this. Our cliff is right back. So, I'm not going to pretend that this is a magic bullet. It's not a panacea. It can still get tricked sometimes, but the halos that trick it are now the exception. They're not the rule. And once you're in that space, you can do a lot of stuff with this. You can pick out the characteristic scale. You can find the point of steepest slope, the geometric mean of the edges. You can do a bunch of different things with this. Now, that said, there are still problems that you can't approach, even with this definition, even once we've gotten rid of the subhalos. And the problem is that if you just pick out a single characteristic scale, you still run into the backsplash problem. Because even if you have the circle in the right place, you can still have halos that travel outside of it because you haven't represented the full 3D shape. So I wrote a code that was specifically designed to deal with this. It's called Shellfish. It took me a long time to come up with that acronym. It was Shell Finding in Spheroidal Halos. I'm very proud of it. And the idea is this. So you have some density field around the center of your halo. And you use some sort of space-filling kernel, so you're not just looking at points. And you draw a bunch of lines of sight around the center of the halo. And when I say a bunch, I mean thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And then for each of these lines of sight, you construct a density profile. You rasterize from the density field onto this. And in these 1D lines of sight, the point of steepest slope is not ambiguous. It is very, very sharp. And you identify it for each line of sight, and then you plot it. Well, not really plot it, you store it. And so what you can see is some of these points of steepest slope, they correspond to filaments. This is probably a bad example because it's not getting tricked by subhalos here, but it can. But you can see that there is very much a shape that is subtended by these points of steepest slope that we'd like to identify. So you come up with some heuristic that you think can separate these filaments from the boundary of this halo. And there's a bunch of different ways you could do it. We came up with one that we really like. And the whole point of it is just to separate the filament from these halo points. And you might note that I'm skipping over this step, and that's because I want you to treat that filtering as a black box. And what you do is you take all the points that survive this, and you fit some wobbly 3D shape to it. You could use spherical harmonics if you wanted. We didn't because there were better things to do. And this is the 3D shape. So because there's a black box, you have to be very careful about trusting this. And we go through a whole host of tests very lovingly in the appendices of these papers. You can check to make sure that the particles at the shell are actually at their epicenters, that there's nothing crazy going on up here. You can do convergence tests and all the parameters. It's great and it's lovely. now, that's it. We're done, right? We don't need anything else. Well, not entirely. So both of these methods have something in common, which is they need to be well sampled in every solid angle around the halo. And what this means is they require a lot of particles for this to work. So it takes about 50,000 particles inside of R200 in order for you to be able to get a shell like this, and a slightly smaller amount for the medium profile method to work. Although the medium profile gets better if you do it in 2D, actually. So what we would really like is something that can do better, because if you look at a billion particle simulation, there's only a couple hundred or a couple thousand halos which actually have 50,000 particles in them. We would like to do something which doesn't need angular information in order to do that, if all we want is the characteristic scale, if we don't actually want this wibbly-wobbly shape. So this might be familiar to you. Bennett gave a talk which talked a little bit about his code Sparta the other day. And part of the point of Sparta is to do exactly this, to get the splashback shell without requiring this insane number of particles. Well, somewhat large number of particles. So the idea here is you're not using the density information, you're using the dynamic information. So you take all the particles that are in the halo, and you look at where their first apocenters were. You find the times of their apocenters, the locations of their apocenters, everything. And then you get a time-dependent distribution of all these apocenter locations. So you have time on the x-axis here, and the radius of those apocenter locations on the y-axis. Now, you might be noticing that this distribution is pretty wide. And there's two reasons for that. So the first is, again, you have these weird potato-shaped shells. And the second is actually that there's a large variety of infall parameters for these particles, which means that a lot of particles are actually turning around before they even get to the splashback shell. Now, in principle, if you knew a bunch about apocenter distributions, this is a gold mine. You could do a ton of stuff like this. For the time being, though, if all we want is a characteristic size, the simplest thing to do is to just calibrate this against the other methods. So you can take a percentile distribution, you can find the percentile that agrees very well with the other definitions, and you can go with it. And then that calibrated definition can look at halos that have a 50th the number of particles that you could do with the other things. Okay, so those are our three methods. Let's just take a breather and let's summarize them. So you have the median profile method. The whole point of this is to be as simple as we could figure out how to do this. Then you have shellfish, which is complicated, but does things in full 3D glory. Then you have Sparta, which requires much fewer particles, but needs to be calibrated against the other definitions, if you want to have a characteristic scale out of it. I should mention, by the way, for the sake of completeness, that we have been looking into ways that you can analyze Sparta without needing to calibrate it against things, but there are problems with all the ways that we've come up with so far. So let's combine these together, and let's look at what the first results and the most important results of our analysis of these methods has been. So this plot here is, in my opinion, probably the most important splashback plot, and you see it in a bunch of different papers. What it is on the x-axis you have accretion rate, on the y-axis you have the splashback radius scaled by R200m. Now, if you haven't spent multiple years just staring at this plot, and you don't know what this esoteric accretion rate definition means, I will give you a sense of it. So the bullet cluster is here. High redshift clusters are about here-ish. Low redshift galaxies are here. And then halos, which are actively being processed and are losing mass, are off about here on the plot. So what I plotted on here is the stacked profile, the thing that I spent a couple minutes at the beginning just talking trash about, all this stuff. And this is what we had for a while. So let's take the medium profile method and let's compare it. So like I promised, the stack profile is biased low relative to the medium profiles. You say, Phil, you overhyped this. That's not that big of a bias. Well, we're not done. There's a mass trend, a very significant mass trend. And the place where the bias is the biggest is for the smallest masses, because those are the masses where the environment had the biggest effect on the outskirts of the halo. And we totally missed this mass trend when we were looking at stack profiles. If you go back and look at the plots now, you can see hints that it was there, but I think we weren't confident in the time that it was statistically reliable. So, but maybe this is just the profile method. Let's compare to other things. So let's put in shellfish. So again, this is the 3D one. Now, shellfish is totally independent of the median profile method. They were not calibrated against one another in any way. And what you can see is you have the same accretion rate trends, you have the same mass trends. You're seeing something suspicious over here, and by virtue of the fact that I'm pointing that out, I happen to know that that suspicious thing is meaningful. You can ask me about that if you want. And let's put in Sparta. So again, this is the one that we had to calibrate against it. So because this particular percentile that we took out of Sparta was calibrated to have the right to have the same amplitude by definition, that's not an independent confirmation of the amplitude. But we didn't calibrate for the accretion rate trends. We didn't calibrate for the mass trends. We didn't calibrate for the redshift trends. We didn't calibrate for the individual scatter between halos that were measured with both Sparta and with shellfish, which turns out to be remarkably small. It's like 7% difference between the two of them. So really what we're seeing here is that all these definitions, which have totally different design philosophies behind all of them, actually agree remarkably well, probably better than we really should have hoped. And so this is one of the big takeaways that I want to get from this. It really summarizes a lot. So it summarizes the bias, it summarizes a mass trend, and it summarizes the fact that these definitions are not competing with one another. They're all telling the same story. So the second big conclusion that I want to get to is more of a dire warning than it is a positive science fact. And it is a dire warning to people who want to do analysis on this sort of thing. And it has to do with overdensities. So what I would have liked when I started this is if we did some analysis and we found out that there was one overdensity which corresponds very well to the splashback shell. Unfortunately, this is not true. Now, I can't stop you from doing analysis where you model the splashback shell as an overdensity sphere, but I will just give you a picture of what your life will look like if you try to do this. So, first off, there is a mass accretion rate trend, right? Just like there was in the radii. There is also a mass trend. There is also intrinsic scatter, very significant intrinsic scatter, actually, because two halos that have the same overdensity parameters can actually have very different splashback shells. But then you have an even worse problem, which is that fundamentally we're treating these points as individual points, as if there's a single sphere that represents them, but we know that they're aspherical. So actually, there's a range of different spheres that you could try to represent this as, and the sphere that you would need would be different depending on what type of analysis you're doing. So actually, each of these points has this huge range to it, and you need to take that into account. So I'm just going to suggest don't try to represent the splashback shell as an overdensity sphere. But if you want to do it, just make sure that you do everything right. So conclusions. Stack profiles are biased. We have a bunch of methods which are pretty much telling the same story. There's a mass trend. It is really dangerous to represent these things as overdensity spheres. You may be able to do it correctly, but it'll be tough. Now, my code for shellfish is in my GitHub repo, which is here. Sparta will be public eventually, but it isn't right now. And you can get an undergrad to write up the median profile method in half an hour. So that's that.
Questions? Do you have any sense for whether the splashback radius for dissipationless dark matter will change if you add baryons?
We don't, and Benedict is looking into that. Now, I suspect that it will be hard for baryons to change the location of the splashback shell, but it's something I definitely think we need to look into explicitly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we've been wrong before. So we're checking it. And I think actually, so here's an argument which you can make in favor of that happening. So a lot of these particle epicenters get pretty close to the center. And we know from, I think Benedict was talking about this in his talk, that we're not really sure about some of the deflection angles and that sort of thing. So it is feasible that that baryons can change it. I shouldn't have been so dismissive. Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I mean, maybe there are fluctuations, though. I think it's still a reasonable thing to check.
I have a very basic, banal question.
I'm afraid.
But no, don't be afraid. this is, I just want to understand what you're talking about for the following reasons. So
yes.
this is what everybody used to call the caustic.
Yes.
Right? Now, the word caustic is a mathematical term.
Yep.
It conveys very clearly that orbits pile up at a center. So I don't understand why there's a need to change the nomenclature, which is confusing because, you know, there's no splashing of anything. These are collisionless particles. So why on earth, is there something new here beyond the caustic, or is it just the caustic?
There's social factors
and
here.
And if it is the caustic, why not just call it the caustic, which is a technically much more compelling term than splashback?
So I happen to think that the term splashback is very pretty. Now, I can give you the history of this term as best as I understand it. So the history of it was that we originally had things called backsplash halos, which were the idea, but at this point they were not associated with the caustic, I believe, right?
Yeah.
So in that sense, coming up with a new name makes sense. And then at one point when the splashback was being studied, an unnamed researcher decided that they wanted to associate the name of this object with these backsplash halos because it was pretty clear that the two were related. But this unnamed person switched those two words and called it splashback by accident.
So as I understand it, I mean, the motivation here is to separate the material that's being through the nonlinear region of the halo from the material that's been falling from the first time in a consistent way, which
I think
is a laudable thing to do. So what I don't understand is why you don't just simply check particle in the simulation whether it goes within R200 or half R200 of the main progenitor and then comes back, because that way, for example, in the outer region, you'll naturally separate the things that are infalling in that region for the first time from the ones which have been through the center, because actually in this region there are both types of of object. And that's an even simpler definition if you implement it at runtime in your simulation.
So sure, you could do that, but let's say that you wanted the 3D shape. You still have to do something non-trivial in order to get the shape.
No,
of that
because
particle
for every halo, you have the list of particles, so you can characterize their 3D shape in any way you want.
Yeah, you can, but you still have to characterize it. You still have to represent the shape somehow. You won't have the problem with the filaments messing you up, but still, the fundamental problem there.
There won't be any filaments messing up with this definition, right? Because they won't be there. They haven't been through the center.
Yeah, so you could if you wanted to. You could list the particles, but what I'm saying is, let's say that you're interested in classifying, or not classifying, let's say you're interested in looking at axis ratios, right? Like you still have to analyze that. Let's say you're interested in looking at asphericity, you still have to classify that.
That's just like a normal analysis of halo, because you just have a list of particles and you do whatever you want.
Well, you're not looking at the shape of the shell then, you're looking at the shape of the mass-weighted distribution.
Fine, so you put a convex hull around it.
Right, but part of the point was though that when you mass-weight things, when you're doing things that look a lot like that, that look a lot like stack profiles, even though you can have two halos where the shape doesn't change at all, but just by virtue of having particles in a subhalo or something, you're changing a lot about the radial distribution of the mass there, right? And so you'll still have to come up with something complicated to deal with that if you want to capture the fact that you're looking at the shapes of these things.
You have to do that whatever you do.
Yep. So what I'm saying is that this isn't a simple panacea.
Alexei.
Hi, Phil. It's really nice stuff. I love this work. Technical question. I misunderstood. You said there was a bias with the medium profiles, but then you showed the splashback radius as a function of accretion rate, and all the methods seem to agree really well. So is that bias just really small?
The bias in the stack profile. So what I was saying is that... Oh, so there were two statements that I made. So one was that you can trick the medium profiles, and the other was that the stack profiles are biased. But the ways that you trick the medium profiles is essentially that the filaments are so strong that you don't see anything, and you just get a wash. So you just get some random splashback radius for those things. So it doesn't actually systematically set this off. It goes into the intrinsic scanner of the medium measurements.
Okay, thank you. I missed that point.
So I just want to comment on questions. So one is to Simon's question. First, to create a list of particles, you kind of have to have an idea about what radius you mean, what is the boundary already. And this is actually what Sparta is trying to do. It tries to analyze the trajectories of particles and define the boundary based on their histories. With respect to the naming, the caustic is a proper name for it. The phenomenon is a caustic, but of course in the halo there could be multiple caustics, right? And so if you want to refer to this one, you'll have to qualify like outermost caustic, right? So essentially, your term has to be two words, right? Some people use second turnaround radius, which is a second turnaround
radius. Unlike splashback, which is one word.
So second turnaround is three words, right? So it's your choice. You use two words, three words, or one word, right? And when I, you know, we didn't invent the splashback name, again, it's somebody else. But when we heard it, I thought immediately that it's going to stick, and there's essentially it's futile to fight it, right? Once it's out in the world, it's going to stick because it's a very catchy name. And therefore, I think that's where we are. If you want to try to change it, I'm all for it. But it cannot be just acoustic. It has to be at least outermost acoustic.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I'll fight for splashback. I like
There was a second reason why we didn't call it caustic. It's because the term acoustic is essentially already taken by people who look at the caustics in phase space in cluster member galaxies. And so we didn't want to confuse with them.
My question was about in the median profiles, right?
Yes.
You have these subhalos which are messing you up.
Yes, or in the stack profiles, you have the subhalos.
Yes. That's what you're trying to remove.
Yes.
So are most of these subhalos actually falling in?
Yes.
And so if that is the case, then if you just try to somehow separate out the infall stream.
I misinterpreted. No, so the ones that are really scary, the ones that are near the inner radius, those can be falling in, or they can be on their splashback journey.
So you have checked that, and it's
50%. So I wouldn't say 50%. I do not remember the numbers because I checked it a year ago.
The number density wise, right? The objects which are turning around should be much smaller than the things which are falling in.
It's closer than you'd want it to be. We looked at this when we were testing these methods. And I can draw up the plots again, and we can look at them. I don't remember the specifics, but I don't think it's a big difference. Right. I think you'd still run into the issue, but you would make it better. Probably.
Well, that goes to what Simon was trying to say.
Yeah. Well, actually, no. Wait. Hold on. So we've tested this too, which is that if you just try to make stacked profiles using only outgoing material, that doesn't actually help you as much as you'd think it would be. It would.
And so the other question would be about observations, right?
Yes.
So what's the better way to do it with observations? Is it median profile?
So this is something I didn't want to talk about because I'm not an observer. I was trying to hint at it obliquely, but the ulterior purpose of the median profile is not just to be simple. It's not just to give us something that we can test our other definitions about. That is the thing which I strongly suspect is going to be how we measure individual splashback radii reliably if we ever end up doing that. So I think probably what a program that did this would look like is you would take some nearby cluster, you'd do a bunch of deep observations in lines going out for them, you'd get number density profiles for that, and you take the median. I have looked into this for maybe a month, not too long, and it turns out to be pretty hard to even get it to show up in simulations, but I don't think that means it's unsolvable. I just think that means it'll be work. Come again? This is one of the things I was looking into, and I don't know the answer. I think we were doing order of magnitude checks at one point.
Bill, so you mentioned that Sparta might be a useful improvement over Shellfish in the sense that it's more efficient. You know, it allows you to probe down to lower halo masses with less particles.
Yes.
You don't need as big of a simulation, but of course, Shellfish works at one instant of time, and Sparta must have a minimum temporal resolution requirement.
Yes.
Actually, there's a big temporal cost of Sparta.
So are we talking about performance costs, or are we talking about the resource requirements that you need to have in order to have this to work?
So they're together.
Yeah. So in terms of performance, actually, I think Sparta and Shellfish are roughly the same speed. So there's some pretty crazy and really fun computational geometry tricks that are going on in Shellfish that don't make it intractable. And I encourage you to read that lovingly created appendix that talks about it. But one thing which you may consider a drawback in Sparta is that you need the full dynamical information for the particles. So you can't just take a single snapshot, which may be a problem if you're using, say, public data sets or something like that. But there are differences there as well.
It's really not a question, just a comment, or just a part of the discussion. But I'll definitely begin by saying this is awesome.
Thank you.
I was really excited about it when these first papers came out, partly because it's kind of natural to want to just distinguish that processed material from the unprocessed material in Halo. So I just wanted to allude to your last point, which is about the deltas. I'm about to make a comment in which we were not very careful about the deltas, so that's the caveat to the comment I'm about to make. So, and you're absolutely right about that. But Benedict and I are planning to look at that, I hope. Right, Benedict? But the point I wanted to make was just that I had a student whose name is Antonio Villarreal. He recently posted a paper on the archive. And the only way that this is related to this is he looked at where are the halos that have anomalous properties that might be associated with assembly bias at the low mass end. And the only caveat is that he found that it didn't coincide with the volumes that you'd naively think would correspond to the splashback radii. So in some sense, for some modeling purposes, even though this is awesome, for some modeling purposes, it might not cure all of our ills. Yeah, so just like you said, it's not a panacea, that's all.
I want to say two quick things about that. One, you're right, that this isn't going to be a panacea. Oh, thank you.
So you're right that this isn't going to cure everything? But one thing I want to caution you about is that the intrinsic scatter will make a big difference in that. And also, if you looked at just the overdensities of the outsides of those shells, they are actually in the right characteristic region. So if you're looking at the maximum distance that a subhalo could get to before you get biased by it, that could, in principle, be at the right scale.
Thank you. Let's thank Phil again.